you can read the title, and I emphasize several things that are on the top of the page, top of the picture. Of course, the goal is QCD, to be able to get to QCD. And I think this is one way of approaching strong coupling. I'll talk more about what you have to do to apply these techniques to QCD later on near the end, after I tell you what they are. I'm being extremely old-fashioned here. I'm using, this is just four dimensions, no CFT, ADS CFT stuff at all. I'm using even a Minkowski metric, which is on the East Coast used to be called God's metric, as opposed to the California metrics. Now, unless you have been really involved in any of the recent field theories that some of us have been doing, by us, by the way, I mean mostly Ian Gabellini from these and myself, who have been doing this particular project. And other things and other relations are being done with for other variations, high temperature theory, field theory. But using these techniques are being started with Thierry Candu of Nice, both people at the Faculty of Sciences in Nice. Excuse me. Anyway. Gabellini and I, over the last six, seven, eight years, have been using a modified Fradkin representation of a modified Schwingerian functional solution. That's all history, and it appears in books, John mentioned. I'm going to write down below just what the functional notation that I'm using. Never mind how we got there, you have to believe me that this is correct. And the third bullet, if that's what it's called, item up there, I want to emphasize, this is a work in progress presentation, and there are one thing that so far we've been able to do some of the Feynman graphs that for the, say, NQED, for the fermion, let's say the electron propagator. And we are just finishing up doing some fine structure on the, that's a joke, doing some fine tuning. The word fine structure came out. I meant doing fine tuning on the photon bubble. This is certainly approximate stuff because you don't see any closed, with the exception of this one, there's no closed fermion loops. So it's a quenched approximation. But that's another whole story, which I think can be improved upon, and we can actually begin to do using these techniques. And in particular, this modified Fradkin representation, we can begin to include quenched effects. But the idea is to approach QCD in this way. But this is something brand new that within the last year or so that has just appeared, and I mean to us, and whether or not it will be useful, I don't know. That's what I mean by a work in progress. I can't guarantee that you're not wasting your hour watching this, but it may be of interest. I think it's the most exciting thing I've seen that has come out of my pen in my lifetime. I may be wrong. I may just be an old man who should be put away somewhere, but it's different. For example, in the fourth bullet, all calculations are done in a special relativistic gauge. You might say, my God, physics is gauge invariant. What are you doing using a special gauge for? It turns out that this gauge forms a bridge into a different sort of formalism. And it's extraordinary when you see it, I think it is. Anyway, you do this, and then you use a certain type of scaling transformation, just like renormalization group transformations, but for every endpoint functions you want to set up, you can do this. It doesn't have to be just a vertex function. Anyway, and so what we're doing is, what I'm going to talk about today, first and foremost, will be the electron propagator, a gauge-dependent quantity, and then I'll talk about the photon propagator, what we're doing with that, where we are talking about a gauge independent quantity, but it's got, we get to that point by this beginning with a particular choice of gauge. Most of this, the essential idea is to calculate not a la Feynman in momentum space, and it may sound absolutely weird, but to do the higher order corrections in which would be important for strong coupling. That's the whole point of doing higher order corrections. To do these things in configuration space. I don't think they've ever been done like that in this fashion before. And I think it's understandable why Feynman propagator of any particle in momentum space is the easy, obvious way to do calculations. The only trouble is in higher orders, you start getting overlapping integrals, overlapping divergent integrals, and one can go mad trying to extract bits and pieces out of the 22nd order, for example. If you're talking about strong coupling, you can't throw away anything a priori.
What about being able to sum a series somehow?
I'm going to sum series by all means, but the summations will be done effectively in configuration space. In this, you'll see. This is trying to give you a taste of what's happening. I'll suppress mass renormalization. That can be done perfectly correctly, but I'm not going to talk about mass renormalization. I will just write down a formula, and at one point in the formula, I'll put quotation marks around something, which means I completely suppress mass renormalization. We don't have to worry about that. So I'd like to begin. Can you see the bottom of the screen? I'd like to begin with, I call the modified Schwinger representation for the electron propagator. And it's given, I like this idea of a pointer. It is a bit heavy. I mentioned to someone that in the States you'd have to have a rifle. With a chamber and a bullet in it, at least, to keep
appropriate.
Here you play hockey. Anyway, here is a Green's function, an ordinary potential theory Green's function, satisfying an ordinary potential theory Green's function equation. A is some fictitious electromagnetic four potential, completely standard. dA, e to the dA, I call a linkage operator, because the exponential of a double functional operator. Sandwiched between these functional derivatives is a free photon propagator. L is this is the standard in momentum space, the standard relativistic photon propagator in an arbitrary gauge, which is specified by zeta. And L of A is the log of the fermion determinant, if you're doing functional potential theory. So everything is well defined. The free particle electron propagator, the free one, is just this GC when you set A equal to zero. And the vacuum amplitude is just E to the dA on E to the L when you set A equal to zero. I don't want to tell you obvious things. If you all have seen this before, I just go much faster. But I just wanted to be clear about what it is that I'm talking about. This is remarkable. Anyway, here is the Fradkin representation, the modified Fradkin representation that I want to use. I don't know if you are familiar with Fradkin. This is Efimov Fradkin, a Russian physicist who died a few years ago, who made fabulous contributions to field theory and gravitational work and all sorts of things. The Fradkin representation itself was done by him shortly after Schwinger produced his first formal functional solutions in field theory in the early 50s. It never got to the West until the mid 60s. And I first learned about it seeing it in nuclear physics article by Fradkin. And I personally have used his representations in one form or another over years, many, many years, as the most convenient way, the most beautiful way of actually giving expression to Schwinger's formal solutions. Schwinger gave formal solutions, and he knew tricks and special cases for coming out with explicit answers. But in general, you look at a formal solution and you can't do much with it, and Fradkin gave you the formalism in which to do this. So the only, when I wrote this transparency, I put this first, this delta function first, and this in the wrong spot. And so this thing should be put back in here. That's the reason for that bizarre picture. So essentially you have a proper time integral, that's the S parameter, over S and then later S prime dependence. V mu is a four vector that depends upon S prime introduced by Fradkin. And the whole point of it is that you have a solution here, you have a solution here in terms of this four vector, operations upon this four vector, V mu, which operations which operate on A mu and on the F mu nu that you construct from A mu. This is an ordered exponential. At the end of all of these operations, you set V mu equal to zero, and you have an exact statement for the potential theory of Green's function. So this is what Fradkin gave you for QED, and you can write it down for any subject, as long as it has a causal nature to the Green's function, which it will always have, you can write down a Fradkin representation for any subject. I've even used it fluid flows. You can use it in any subject, any type of any number of coordinates and so forth. Now, what I want to do is take this original Fradkin representation and switch from V mu to a different variable, which is just the integral. V mu, you can think of it as a four velocity of a particle. U mu is going to be the position coordinate in xyz t space of a particle, except that it's not exactly true, because you have to do a functional integral over all possible values of u. I'm going to perform the linkage operations. The e to the dA, curly dA I showed you before, I'll perform on this and on this, I will write down the corresponding curly S prime. This is the full electron propagator in terms of this. And there's a numerator factor here. I put in parenthesis because I've already done the mastery normalization. I don't want to talk about that. That will take the rest of the hour. So please be kind enough to forget mastery normalization. I'll put it in later in a different way, but for the exponential factors. But anyway, this is exactly what you get from this representation when you make the change of variables from Fradkin's V mu to the U mu that Gavolini and I have found convenient to use. You have a functional integral, which is messier than any sort. This is Fradkin's linkage operator, if you wish. You have a functional integral, which is messier because it requires a normalization. Everything here can be perfectly well defined, and I hope I have done it down below. This is the photon propagator. If you take that previous linkage operator and just operate on this thing, you'll get two V's, one at each side, two D by the A's, will give you a V, with a S1 and an S2, but a V is now at U prime, so here's the U prime, here's the U prime, and the photon propagator in the middle. Okay? That's what you get just from doing that. When you take the linkage operator and try to operate into a ordered exponential, this is a non-trivial thing, but what you have to do is extract the F mu nu out of the ordered exponential, leave inside the ordered exponential some other field, anti-symmetric chi mu nu, and then just write down ordinary functional translation operators to put the rest of the material back into the ordered exponential. This is an old trick. Gavolini and I used this years ago. And it's just a simple way of extracting the field strength on which you want to operate functionally, which I've now done already, from the ordered exponential. But of course, at the end of the day, if you stay in configuration space, you are stuck. to do perturbation theory for the rest of your life, because you have to evaluate this, and there is no way known to man or beast for evaluating ordered exponentials in general. You can, there's an adiabatic limit, and you can define the stochastic limit, two completely opposite limits. But in general, you can't, there is no analytic expression for these things. Which means that you have to do it perturbative order by perturbative order if you stuck to configuration space. One of the reasons why one never does Feynman graphs in configuration space, you go to momentum space, the intelligent thing to do. Anyway, I'm using the definition, the notation little z here, to define u of s1 minus u of s2. Because I don't want to keep writing it all over again and again. I'll call this combination, this difference, delta u. H is a function that appears in these functional analyses always. It's the smaller of S1 and S2. There are various representations for it. This is a convenient one. A is a real positive number, which goes to 1 at the end of the calculation. It's introduced because I'm going to be doing scaling transformations later, and I don't want to have to go to the trouble of scaling proper times, and therefore scaling momenta and so forth and so on. So instead of doing that, I introduce this particular parameter A here. You could set A equal to 1, and you'd be perfectly correct. That's the answer. You're supposed to set A equal to 1. But I want to keep it here in the functional integrand and in the normalization, because it will be useful to keep it there. But A goes to 1 at the end of the calculation. First observation, which to me, I say, was a complete surprise. If you take this operator, the one that stands here, and just this alone on the ordered exponential, the result is remarkably 1. Every order g squared vanishes. To me, this was a fabulous surprise. I was completely surprised. I did it first for g squared, and I got 0. Isn't that charming? I did it for g fourth, and I got 0 again. I did it for g6, the long, hard way, took weeks. I got 0 again. And it dawned on me, this is probably a general formula. I cannot give you a proof that it exists. I won't do it today, but there's a proof that, an easy proof that it exists. That easy proof took about half a year to figure out, but it was clear that it was going to be true for all times. I gave this talk to, Annecy in France, in particular to Raymond Stora, if you know Raymond Stora, who's one of the old-timers, he's our generation.
BRS2.
Yes, he's BRS2. He's also, even before that, he's, to my mind, one of the most knowledgeable people. And he stopped me at this point, and he said...
He once gave a talk from him.
He stopped me and he said, that's very interesting. He said, I believe you, but why? And I said, what do you mean, why? I can prove it. He said, I don't doubt you can prove it, but why is it? What the principle? Symmetry here, a spectacular thing there. And I tell you, I don't know why. It's very embarrassing. I do not have the principle, the symmetry, or what have you, to tell you exactly why this is true. But it is true. Anyway, it simplifies one's life down tremendously, because you can just forget this particular term. You cannot forget that term. And that's has to be taken into account if you are going to do any sort of calculations. That's the remark that's made at the top of the page here. The U prime ordered to linkages to the ordered exponential, OE stands for ordered exponential. A capital OE stands for ordered exponential. A small OE stands for ordinary exponential. Sorry, I threw that in. Just for humor. And one has to figure out how to handle these things. Because the order of exponential there means you are in terrible trouble, generally speaking, if you try to use configuration space to do higher order terms. The second observation, and this is the thing that I want to really point to, there's a special gauge which is extremely useful. Here I've written the momentum space free photon propagator. I'm using the old-fashioned k squared is equal to k vector squared minus k zero squared, so I have a minus I epsilon in the way I do it. If you take the Fourier transform, it's very simple, and this is what you get. You get two terms, the ordinary term with a little modified coefficient, and something that looks more complicated. Now, I put over here a little table with the three standard gauges that one uses, the famous Feynman gauge. You use it for simplicity. You set zeta equal to zero. Landau gauge is good for when you want to discuss, it's useful when you want to discuss ultraviolet behavior. The Yenny gauge, where zeta is equal to minus 2, is very good for infrared behavior. I was Yenny's second graduate student, and we were doing lamb shift calculations, all low energy stuff. And Yenny invented this gauge. I was standing next to him at the blackboard when he invented it. And it's remarkably useful. What do you use a gauge for? It simplifies your calculations. The final calculations, of course, have to be gauge invariant. But a particular gauge can simplify your calculations tremendously. I want to point to a gauge, the usefulness of a gauge where zeta is equal to plus 2. I call that the special gauge. And this whole term will disappear. The simple term disappears, leaving only the more complicated term. This sounds like a crazy thing to do, but let's just see what it is, what happens. I call this the special gauge. I don't have enough hubris, chutzpah, whatever you want to call it the free gauge. But I hope that after I die, which hopefully will not be too long, will not be too soon, this will be the free gauge. That's what I'd like to have on my epitaph, if any of you remember it, you know. Anyway. I'll define this gauge in this way, and this is what the propagator becomes. And why this gauge? Well, look at the simplest term that we have to evaluate, just this particular term. And delta, we talked about it before. And then you see that you can break this term apart. There are two denominators, and there are two parts of the numerator. Each z becomes a delta u. So you have a u prime of s1 divided into a u, a delta u. And you have a u prime of s2 dotted into another delta u, and or combined with it. And this term is just the partial derivative of log of z. And this term is just with a minus sign, the same thing. And so this entire thing, in that gauge, this looks just like this. And the gamma is proportional to g squared. That's interesting. And when I looked at it, I still get this frisson, this cold shiver down my spine when I talk about it, because it looks almost like a perfect differential. It is not a perfect differential, because this depends upon S2, and this one depends upon S1. If it was a perfect differential, I mean, just imagine how simple life would be, because if it was a perfect differential, it would be just evaluated at the edges that where the u variables are either zero or s, and then at those there are well defined statements I forgot to mention before. U of s is minus z, and u of zero is zero, which means that you could evaluate these logs in terms of the endpoint terms. All the u fluctuations in the middle would cancel out. Of course, it's not a perfect differential. So what I just said is wrong. You can't do. But what you can do is to rewrite that term so that at least part of it is a perfect differential. At least part of it is a perfect differential. For example, this is exactly the same thing that I had in the bottom of the previous transparency. Take the derivative with respect to either of these, and you'll find that you get what we had down there, and this piece will cancel off. So it's exactly the same thing. But the first term is a perfect differential. It's evaluated only in terms of the u's at the endpoints, and u of 0 is 0, u of s is minus z. So this is what the first term contributes. You work it out, kaboom. It comes right out of the functional integral. And what's left of the functional integral is just this thing, the term with the log z and the second derivatives. Now, how do you calculate the second term? I put down on the blackboard two ways that come to mind. The first way, I thought this was going to be a useful approximation. I still think it's a strong coupling, quote, approximation, because a log. Logs of ordinary things, as long as the thing doesn't become, the argument doesn't become zero. And in this case, the argument will never become zero because the argument is always cut off with an I epsilon. Logs are always slowly varying quantities, or usually. So why not replace first approximation? Why not replace this log by its average value, averaged over the U fluctuations and over the S12 variables? And if you did that, you'd bring it outside this integral as a number, function of S, function of Z. And this quantity is a perfect differential. And you'd be done. You'd be absolutely finished, because this quantity you can evaluate exactly. And all you have for the remaining functional integral, if this is all, if you only had this term, all you have would be the essentially kinematic part of it, which you can evaluate immediately. Is this clear? I mean, if I'm forgetting the, I'm forgetting that ordered exponential contribution. Suppose it wasn't there. But this part you could do immediately. So this would be a way of expanding in powers of, not expanding in powers of coupling constant, but if you could, you could certainly calculate averages of this thing, and it's a leading approximation to something you can then look for correction terms. I thought this was really great, and for months I worked on it until it hit. That instead of playing with this thing, there's a much more interesting thing to do, which brings you into the world of renormalization group methods. So instead of playing with this log, let's add and subtract this term. It looks just like this, except that I'm replacing this thing by some arbitrary quantity I call log of q. In this exponent, I'm going to add and subtract just this term. Q is a real positive number larger than 1. Let's do that and see what happens. So I've written every single step here just to be absolutely clear. There's the first, this is the thing that we're trying to calculate. And I'm going to put this term in and subtract it out over here. Okay? I can also put the q underneath this term because I've taken derivatives, and that would never touch, that would not change this term. Is that okay? So instead of this term, we have these two things. This term is exactly a perfect differential. It just comes right out of the functional integral. And what we're left with is this thing. I'll just write it in this fashion. M squared, by the way, I forgot to mention, is some arbitrary mass squared that I put in. There's a useful, we'll see what it is later on in this particular case, but it's just a parameter to keep the dimensions correct inside the integral, since the delta u has dimensions of length. So if you divide by q, then if I divide epsilon by q, I still get an I epsilon. Q is some arbitrarily large number, some arbitrary positive number. And let's rescale. I'll call the rescaled u's, I'll call u bars. And if you do this consistently in the entire functional integral, this is the functional integral you're looking at now. It still has the original ordered exponential piece in it, one half of that piece here. After the scaling, after you rescale, I call this thing I of z squared a. This is the original one. And after I perform the rescaling, this is what you find, that the original one is equal to this quantity times this function I, 1, 2, 3 arguments, and here's that function of 3 arguments. It looks similar, except that every place you see a z, it's a z over the square root of q. Every place you see an a, it's an a over q. And here are all the z, here's the z of u bars. And here is this term, the ordered exponential term that was still left over previously. And it's got a 1 over q dependent sitting out in front of it. Okay? It's just what you see. Now, this is not a useful scaling relation, I must say, because you have this extra stupid piece you still don't know what to do with. But what happens if you start letting q get arbitrarily large, larger and larger and larger? This piece is going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. I can take this q and transform it, make a 1 over q over here by changing the chi definitions. there'll be less and less contribution from this piece. Where is the contribution gone? It's gone up here. This is the contribution from this miserable thing that gives you, in every order of perturbation theory, gives you a law of divergence, ultraviolet law of divergence. And where does it reappear? It reappears right up here. You let Q become arbitrarily large. I don't want to say infinity. Arbitrarily large, this contribution becomes arbitrarily small, and you can forget about it. And its contribution is sitting right up here in your hand, the exponential of something proportional to g squared times the log of that divergent piece that would be coming out of every order of perturbation theory here, and it's sitting right up here. Of course, you can say, well, what happens? You have a 1 over q squared. Don't worry about that. It's going to disappear for a different kinematical reason. But it's this thing that the sum of all of the miserable miseries of this term appears upstairs here. And I think this is a fabulous calculational tool. Unless I am missing the boat completely, I think this is something that one should absolutely look at and see what it leads to. So that's what I'm going to do, is to imagine that this Q is going to become arbitrarily large subsequently, and I am going to therefore completely forget about calculating this term. I will this set of terms, perturbative terms, saying that they all, their effect comes up in that term. To my knowledge, this sort of thing has not been done before by anybody. That may mean that it's wrong, basically, but then again, you never know. I think it's an interesting thing to try, and the results are very charming when they come out. So let's see what happens. Now we have a useful scaling relation for this quantity. The scaling relation looks like this. I've thrown away those ordered exponential remnants because they came after, there was a semicolon here, and a term that went like 1 over q. I'd forgotten those. And here's a scaling relation. I should mention that the terms from the ordered exponential are gauge invariant. They involved f mu nu's originally. And this special gauge allows, is the bridge, I call it, or the framework for their summation. So, speaking.
Do you have an idea of how big Q has to be?
Q is going to become arbitrarily large, and then when we get all done, we will set it equal to 1. This may sound crazy, but the point is that Q is going to be, all the remaining Q dependencies automatically disappear.
So arbitrarily large compared to what?
Compared to any number you feel like making, any positive number. You allow, pick a number, 10 to the 84th, and I'll be large compared. I don't want to set it equal to 0 yet.
So suppose I want the first one, the expansion of the exponential, to be a correction of 100.
Yes.
How big does Q have to be?
I don't know, because I don't want to do the correction that way. That's a ghastly thing to do. I mean, you can do it.
Is there just a kind of scale, rather than a number, is there a sort of scale?
No, it's a number. It's a number scale at this point. Speak. As far as I understand. I mean, if you see a way of doing it differently, by all means,
as an analogy for the normalization theory works, because if you have a cutoff,
it's independent. I'm about to do that.
And the cutoff goes to infinity, the result is independent of that.
Yes.
So the Q, you do the calculation, and you show that the final result is independent of Q becoming large.
The final result will be independent of Q becoming large.
Good.
That's exactly what happens.
That's excellent.
That's excellent. Exactly what happens. And the way, I mean, I said before, you can let Q equal 1, because when Q becomes arbitrarily large, you don't even see it anymore, because the way the Z squared and the A dependence appears in every order of every perturbative order of this thing.
So it's a form of regularization.
It's a form, if you wish, it's a form of, I've extracted an infinite, those logarithmic divergences that were there, so you couldn't use configuration space, but I've extracted them out, now you can use configuration space, and now we will use due configuration space by renormalization group methods. And there's a worry at this point, because you can say, you're evaluating a functional integral, I'm going to make a differential equation, a functional differential equation. like a renormalization group would tell you to do. And I'm going to be solving a differential equation, functional or not, a differential equation, then you have to worry about uniqueness of your solution. Mm-hmm. And I'll handle that in a different way. Okay? The solutions I get for the electron propagator will not be mathematically unique. I call them physically unique, and you'll see what I mean when we get there.
Does this lead to a beta function?
It leads to the whole thing. I'll write down the entire propagator in this gauge.
Rc flow, the whole thing.
Well, I think the whole thing is there.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you'll see. There's lots that remains to be done, I must say. And I've just been finishing this and then going on to the photon thing, which is using these techniques for a gauge invariant object plus something else. And the something else is something that I have to finish. Anyway, let's use the renormalization group methods. The left-hand side is independent of Q. The right-hand side depends upon Q. So we take the derivative with respect to Q. We're going to get zero. So we have an equation that says zero equals, and take the derivative with respect to Q. You'll always get a 1 over Q cubed term from everything you do. So I throw that away and throw away this exponential factor. And this is what you have. It's a differential equation. In terms of these variables, Z squared and A. Now, here's a differential equation, and one wants to look for solutions. In order to look for solutions in a simple way, what I've done is to rescale. I let z squared go to z squared q and a go to a q, just to get rid of these 1 over factors. That means you pick up an extra log q factor from here. And at the very end, I have to remember to go back, and when I look at my solutions, to go back and do the inverse transformation. But that will be trivial. So here's the renormalization group style integral equation for this functional integral, which remember still has the kinematical parts, and then there's the exponential of the log and the double derivative of another log, which is sitting up in there. And I don't want to do those things by perturbation. So I'm looking at the differential renormalization group differential equations to do it. I'm going to look for a solution of this form where when you set g equal to 0, s prime just looks like this thing. In configuration space, this is like the free boson propagator, or the free propagator part of this fermion solution, which doesn't have the numerator m minus gamma dot del factors in it. So it's essentially bosonic looking. But I want this to be This thing comes just by what you can do the functional integrals for g equals 0 very easily. And I insist that when g goes to 0, it should look like this. And why? Because you can talk about a landscape of solutions to Schwingerian functional equations. You can make functional equations. Jerry Aramick's been doing this for years. But I want, out of that landscape, I want solutions to the Schrodinger equations which go to the free one, the free solution, when g goes to 0. That's, you don't have to do that, but I want that. So this is one condition. Also, I'm going to say that this quantity j, when you let a go to 1, as we'll do later on, and you let z squared go to 0, then I want this thing to go to 1 so that the equal time anti-commutation relations that you originally assumed for your interacting fields are the same as what we always got for the free fields. This is one of the first things you do in quantum field theory. You look for solutions such that the equal time anti-commutation relations for fermions or commutation relations for bosons for the dressed fields are the same as for the undressed, as for the same as for the bare fields.
So you have a way of going to the Heisenberg representation.
It's all, well, I mean, it comes from Heisenberg representation, but this is just a functional expression of that. That's all. I mean, there's no more operators left in here. It's the functional expression of all of the products that you would get from operators. So I'm going to insist on this because I want to make sure that I'm talking about the field theory that Schwinger set up a long time ago. So with these caveats, let's look at the solutions. Let's set this, the unknown quantity is J. Let's set J equal to E to the omega. and then look at the differential equation for omega, and here's what it looks like. And now at this particular point, you notice that on the right-hand side, there's no A dependence, only Z dependence and the Q dependence. At the end of the calculation, A is going to be set equal to 1. And since there's no A dependence on the right-hand side, I'm going to imagine that, I mean, what's going to happen is that all the A dependence that you could add would just correspond to some constant or other. And I'm going to choose that constant. I'll choose it below, but I'm going to just imagine that the A, we can set A equal to 1 now. And we'll worry about any other constant that the A dependence would give us later on. This is just looking for the solutions to this thing. So you could say, Fried, you're not being unique. And I agree with you. I'm taking a great big step away from uniqueness because I'm looking for a particular form of solution. So be it. So I'm going to look for a solution of this where the omega depends only on z squared or z squared plus I epsilon. And I'll denote little y by the log of z squared plus I epsilon times some that m squared, again, the same m squared we were talking about just for dimensional reasons. The trivial differential equation to solve. Here's the solution, kappa is a constant. That means that j looks like this. If you add in the previous perfect differential forms, which were these things, the entire answer I forgot to say on the transparency, you go back to your transformation about the Z, the A, the Q, A is 1 though. What you get is an answer that looks just like this. And here's your kappa. The answer for, that curly S prime is the I zero times the exponential of all of this junk. Kappa is a constant, you don't know what it is. You insist that when z squared goes to zero for the equal time anti-commutation relations, that this curly bracket should go to zero. That defines the constant kappa. And I throw in an extra delta m squared. I know what delta m is because I told you I can do it. So I'll throw in a delta m squared up there, here, so I can renormalize the other m squared that was sitting in the e to the minus I s m squared integral proper time representation. Anyway, when you get all done, the entire result looks like this. And so this is the solution for this fermion propagated in configuration space. It's the free one that I had written down before, multiplied by this quantity. It's a multiplicative, logarithmically divergent, z squared dependent factor. And now what you have to do, if you want to, is take its Fourier transform. What I'll do here is what I did originally, is not calculate the Fourier transform. I want to calculate z2. Let me just make a comment. When you calculate, you try to calculate an electron wave function, electron propagator, excuse me. Why do you do it? I mean, it's of no interest whatsoever except for the Z2 factor in front. Because if you take the Z2 factor, you'll need that Z2 factor when you calculate a vertex function to kill off the Z1 factor. You'll need that Z2 factor. If you calculate any other endpoint functions, you'll need that Z2 factor to appear in just the right way so that the entire answer will be gauge invariant. We've all done these things in perturbation theory. So I want to just ask you, I want to just show what this Z2 would be for the solution I've written down without bother going through the trouble of taking the Fourier transform. I've done that, but let me just guess it. Let's just guess it because it's easy to guess. This is the first way I did it. Going to the mass shell in momentum space means that the z squared in configuration space is large. So imagine z squared becoming plus infinity. And so in order for that to happen, let's replace z squared by 1 over mu squared, just like at infrared divergence. In fact, if you were doing QED, you'd be finding infrared divergences all over. And that corresponds to the z squared getting large in configuration space. The epsilon that was in those things in configuration space is like the inverse of the momentum space cutoff, the ultraviolet cutoff. And so let's replace epsilon by lambda to the minus 2, which is the ultraviolet, familiar ultraviolet cutoff. The z squared going to infinity is like the infrared statement. And the curly bracket then just becomes this, as a real and an imaginary part. If you want the z2 to be real, as you certainly should, then this quantity should be equal to 1. And that tells you what m squared, how m squared should be chosen. And if you put that in here, what you find out is that the z2 will look like this. And I think it's amusing to mention this, because it comes out just as you want it to come out, in principle, between 0 and 1. I mean, these things are cutoffs, and so it's a finite number as it stands, but it's always, z2 is always supposed to be between 0 and 1. It's a physical, not mathematical, uniqueness. Suppose you take any other solution that satisfies the two conditions I spoke about, when g squared goes to 0 and z squared goes to 0, and say, no, I don't like this solution that you've written down free. I want to use this, introduce these functions. What will happen? You'll change the z2. You'll change the propagator, but the only part of the propagator you care about is the z2. You'll change the z2. But that's okay, as long as you keep that z2 and use that consistently in all the other steps, then you'd be home. You'd have a similarly useful sort of solution. So here is my physically unique, quote-unquote, and simple-minded solution for the fermion propagator, in particular the z2, doing it in this particular way, in configuration space, and taking Fourier transform, this is what you'll get. In this analysis, I do things in configuration space, and then at the end, of course, you have to take Fourier transform. That's another problem, another thing that you can do. There are cuts that you, well, I'll talk about the cuts later on when we get to the photon propagator. What I want to do now, I've finished my time almost. Can I go for a little bit more?
Yeah, we started at 5 minutes.
I want to talk about the photon propagator. I want to look at this K mu nu quantity, and I've written it down underneath here. It's not the photon propagator, but it's if you look at the inverse of the photon propagator, this is the relevant piece that you'd be looking at. And it is just the sum of all Feynman graphs written in this way. And here are the two Green's functions. That the way you write this down, if you do functional games, then you know exactly what this should look like. And it must satisfy the statement of gauge invariance. People, you always say, I call it current conservation. Yes,
I'm sorry. Can I go back to your last point?
Where?
Z2. So now that we...
I'm sorry, go back.
When we started talking about Z2.
Yeah.
So where it shows up is this m squared ends up having a factor of q in it.
Oh, yeah, I picked an m squared, so... Yeah.
And you're going to be an iron. But can I think about that actually being why these things, as I go through, should have been independent of q anyway, the final result? Because I always could have just chosen my cutoffs differently to...
Sure, you can do it. Then in the non-unique, mathematically unique solution I chose, you would then choose it differently, you'll get an imaginary part for z2. I don't want an imaginary part. You can always choose another function you can multiply in so that the m squared effectively would be different, but you want to keep a real z2. I mean, I like to keep a real z2. If you look at what these things are used for, there's only usefulness, the only reason you're interested in z2 is so you have it in your hand, and you can always show that when you calculate a vertex function, the z1s and the z2s cancel. When you do every other endpoint function that involves electron propagators, electron scattering, fermion scattering, blah, 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 you always have to know what the z2 is to get rid of it. So that's why I said this is physically unique. The fact that I don't care what the m squared is, it doesn't bother me at all. It's m squared is just like, if you wish, think of it as q, but I don't really care. Besides, you've got an epsilon, the lambda to the fourth is something completely different. That's an ultraviolet, that's the epsilon that was there, ultraviolet cutoff. So, I mean, if you want to do it differently, that's fine. But the idea of being able to sum up all of these g squared contributions in configuration space is the, to me, the novel thing. and in a relatively easy way of doing it. So if I can just get on to this this part, which is really, which is the part that is still, which is probably the most interesting part, because this is a gauge invariant thing. This condition that the partial mu k gives you of this quantity must equal zero, you can call it current, you can call it gauge invariance. It's really an expression of current conservation, and it must be true in QED for all processes, real and virtual. Now, it was a great embarrassment if you, the audience, with the exception of you, John, the audience wasn't born when this problem of the photon self-mass appeared in the early 50s, 1950 or something like that. If you just write down a loop, I mean, we've all done this kind of exercise in Feynman graph, write down the loop and evaluate it. And you find that the folks, that there's a non-gauge invariant part, doesn't satisfy that, and it corresponds to a quadratic mass, for the quadratically divergent mass for the photon. Could anything be more absurd on two grounds? It's not gauge invariant, and it gives a photon a mass, and the photon's mass is divergent. I mean, it's completely crazy. Why? It's completely crazy because even though if you write this property, forget the linkage operator, this property, without the linkage operator, this property, the divergence of this property, is easy to show just from the definitions of the G's. Potential theory. And it works beautifully. It's always zero. On the other hand, when you put the linkage operator in, what you're doing is looking at the fluctuations. The fluctuations are so singular. You know there's a quadratic divergence in this loop, plus a logarithmic divergence. The divergences are so severe that the symmetry, the current conservation, or gauge invariant symmetry that's underneath that, is just thrown off kilter. It just can't be satisfied.
I understand that I recently used exactly this property, which is forgotten by people, to get the W and the Z.
Yeah.
Mass.
Sure.
Mass is photon from the propagator without a Higgs bar.
Good.
It's on the website. Yeah,
good. I mean, it should be used. Yes.
Yeah, you break it to break the symmetry of the measure as a measure that comes into the particle conformism.
Well, you'll be able to make a good suggestion for the next transparency. I mean, yes, because the trouble is, it's always been a trouble, and you have to. It was 50 years ago. It was figured out how to do it. Pauli and Weisskopf invented not Weisskopf. Pauli and Vilas invented their little method for taking care of this. Sort of a cute little algebraic method. Essentially, you imagine that you sum over different electron masses. And called the Pauli-Villars method. This was the late 40s, tail end of the 40s. In his famous paper on gauge invariance and vacuum polarization in 51, one of the best papers ever written in my mind, Schwinger, in an appendix, showed those guys what they were doing is correct. They just did it as a trick. This problem has been taken care of when you put loops in and so forth in many different ways. In my first book, I use the method of split point method, which guarantees that that you always get current conservation, and you put that in, and then you have horrible intervals in momentum space to do. It's about 2 or 3 pages of algebra, and you come out with a result that satisfies this for the simplest loop. Well, what I'm going to do is put in a representation complete with, in this special gauge, complete with functional integral for this G, I almost said J, but for this G, when you talk in French, the G's and J's are interchanged. And you always, I mean, when you give a talk in functional methods, you're always talking about a Green's function depending upon the source J. And so you have to talk about, instead of G as a functional of J, you have to talk about J come functional de G. And I can go mad. I almost did it. Anyway. There will be a functional integral over parameter u of s's in this one. There will be a functional integral over parameter w of t's in this one. They look exactly the same, practically, except
Here, U of S is equal to minus Z, Z is X minus 1. Here, U of S, U of W of T will be Z, which will be X minus 1, plus X minus 1. I'm getting, if you insist on stopping me at the hour, then I'll never get to the end of this. I'm almost there. So what you do is, here are the steps to do. What you do is you insert these functional integrals, choose a special gauge, and you note that all of these terms will always disappear. I'll perform mastery normalization for both functional integrals, same thing. I'm going to insert plus and minus log Q for the terms from S1 and S2, that's the fluctuations across one line, the terms T1 and T2, the fluctuations across the other line, and the fluctuations S1 and T1, those are fluctuations between the two. Okay? All of that stuff is there in this exponential. I add plus or minus of these things. I rescale, and I take Q very, very large. And what do you find? Of course, in the remainder, you find all the exponential factors cancel. They were gauge dependent in the other problem. They're not here anymore at all. All the factors cancel, and what you're left with is integrals over the U's and the W's. You can rescale. You rescale, you have Z's. Everything else falls out except this particular quantity. It just sits there, and you have functional integrals. Everything else had a 1 over Q factor in it, or a 1 over the square root, something which became arbitrarily small as Q became arbitrarily large. This quantity is just perfectly well defined in this gauge. It looks like this. Now, what do you do with these? This is U prime of S. Remember, U of S is minus Z. W of T is plus Z. What is U prime? What is W prime? They're infinite quantities. These are the quantities that give you the miserable quadratic divergences when you calculate K2. K2 would just be the very first, the G squared, just a closed loop without any other fluctuations. What you have, I'll write down, as far as I understand this entire thing, I'll write down this quantity K, I'll write it in this fashion, and I'll pluck out this stuff from underneath the functional integrals. I'll just put an average over here. I have the U prime and the W prime of S and T. I don't know what to do with, but I just don't want to keep writing functional integrals, so I'll call it average value. And this is the whole functional integral with all the Q factors still sitting in there, Q arbitrarily large. Okay? And this quantity is independent of Q, that we know. And now I play the same sort of game since K mu nu, this is the sum of all the such things, is independent of Q. I can do a renormalization group equation on it. But you notice that there's no inhomogeneous terms left because all those exponential factors canceled out. And this is all you have. And this is, it's almost embarrassing at this point because you can think of definite ways of satisfying this, that relation. But the question is, which one are you going to choose? What else is necessary? Let's look to see, first of all, how that relation can be satisfied and how it can be independent of Q. Remember, we have 1 over Q fourth sitting out front, and then the functional integral has Q's in it. Let's see how it's satisfied when you set G squared equal to 0. So I'll look at C0 of Z squared and A, direct functional integration, and what you get out is the formula that looks like this. In other words, I forgot to put another factor of phi over here. The integrals, forget, don't do the integrals over S and T and so forth. Forget this exponential factor. Just look at the exponential here and this A fourth dependence. All the rest I forgot to write down in a separate factor phi. And I'll call S bar the sum of 1 over S plus 1 over T. And this thing is independent of Q. That's the point. I said that the functional integral has to be independent of Q. How could it be? Well, let's look at this function. Let A go to 1 over A over Q. You're going to get a Q factor, Q to the fourth upstairs. This cancels it out. Let Z squared go to Z squared over Q. Let A go to A over Q.
that gets canceled out right here.
If the z-squared dependence has the form z squared over a, and if there is this kinematical factor, 1 over a fourth, 1 over a squared from each fermion line out front, after you scale it, then the answer is independent of q. At this point, let q get arbitrary, let q go to infinity. You don't care. Because for g squared equals 0, you see that there's no q remnant at all. Now, I'm going to assume, here you can say I'm lacking uniqueness, but I'm going to say this is the obvious way to get a solution of the form of z squared and a. Let's let every one of these things have this factor, exponential I z squared over 4 a bar s, and this quantity phi is all the rest of it with a 1 over a fourth. I will look for solutions of, I will assume that this functional integral can be expressed as something such that every order in g squared, of course I forgot to write the g squared to the 2nth up here, I have the coefficient. There's a g squared to the 2nth should be here. Every one of them has this kinematical factor, so to speak, out front, and then some other function of z squared over a. And then when I look for solutions of this thing, I mean, there's no q dependence anymore. Q has gone to infinity, there's nothing. I'm going to have to make a different, I've used up all the functional information from the renormalization group. What can you use? And this is what I want to use as a computational tool. I'll demand that this is true in every g squared order. I'll write down this functional equation in every g squared order, introducing these factors such that the q dependence would, if you wanted to keep the q in there, it would all disappear. But what the hell, I'll just set a equal, I'm going to forget the q, set a equal to 1, and then just pop in every order of this functional integral, I'll just extract this kinematical factor, I've set a equal to 1, and I'm going to start writing down all the orders. I can write down all the orders, and then I can write down differential equations for every order. I can write down the sum, write a differential equation for the sum of every order. And these will be first-order differential equations, and they will have a constant. They will require the specification of one constant for the solution, and that constant will have all powers of g squared. So that's what I want to do. However, what I want to the first way of doing this was to, what I've done here, I'm going to, for this presentation, let's put it like that, for this presentation, I'm going to use the same average of this quantity for all terms, for K2, K4, and K6, and so forth. We know very well from perturbation theory that the trouble, the horrible, that the quadratic divergences only come in second order. In fourth order, you have to be careful because you have log divergences, you have those renormalization at all times. But because fourth order still requires a by hand assurance that that this is true. The other orders should work much nicer. So they should not require any special arrangements. On the other hand, what I'm doing here, just for simplicity, is to use the same average value. And the way I'll do it will just be to say this average value I'll define, quote, quote, by writing down the K2 in this fashion. And using the K2 in configuration space, I know what it is in momentum space, I think it's Fourier transform. It was done half a century ago or more. And so I can just write this down and with that just define this. That's really not right. Because it should be defined differently in the next order for K4. I say that for K2 and for K4, if you gave me those two things, I can then write down the solution for everything. I have to stop. Let me show you what the solutions look like, and then I stop. I wanted to say a word about QCD2. I don't know, how far does this get us? Can't remember what's here. This is K2. This is K2. But writing K2 in a particular way that I know because we did this half a century ago. What is G4th in this notation? It looks like this. You pick up a new C2, and you have a C0 with the same factors here. That means that K4 can be written as C2 times K2 plus this extra term, which we know everything about. And says C0 is equal to 1 because I've taken these factors out of it. And so, since the partial derivative has to be equal to 0, this gives you a differential equation for C2, a first-order differential equation. You specify one constant, and when you know C2, then you know K4. What's the G6 term? I suppress the S and D dependent. K6 will be equal to C4 times K2 plus the same thing that we knew before, but now here's the C2 that we just calculated. And so, since the derivative must be equal to 0, you have a differential equation for C4. And when C4 is known, then you know K6. Und so wieder. You continue doing the same thing down. You do this to the nth order, and then you sum up all the terms, and you have a differential equation for the sum of all terms. I repeat that we made a tiny little mistake, which is going to show up later, because we use the same one of these things. And I should have rescaled that thing. But I didn't, just for simplicity. We're doing that now. We're taking that into account in a slightly different fashion. I'm sorry to keep you longer, but what the hell? I think this is novel and interesting. Should be interesting.
Well,
do you want me to stop now?
I have to quit this one.
I know. Can I just do this and I'm done?
Yeah.
All right. So here's the sum of the entire business, and. I write down differential equations for everything, and the final thing can be written in this particular fashion. I prefer to write it in where you know what this thing is to within one constant. I put this away. I have just one more thing to show, just to wave my hand at. Man, well, that's it. So let me summarize. I'm sorry to keep you this long. Let me just summarize this thing. And I'll tell you what's wrong as soon as I finish the summary. So you do the Schrödinger fraction, you do use a Schlesinger gauge, you rescale with large Q. If there's an homogeneous term for the two-point function, then you have a differential equation. Otherwise, you use current conservation or gauge invariance. And you solve these things, then you have to take Fourier transform. So I'm done. But let me tell you two more things. Generalization to QCD, and I want to tell you just in words, of 30 seconds, what happens with the K4. To check this stuff, what we did was to calculate K4 using these techniques. I have a calculation for all endpoints, for all the vacuum polarizations given in this way, arbitrary order. Calculate K4 because that's been done in the literature. The literature is 50 years old. If you look at the literature, you find the most god-awful mess you can imagine. A couple of people have done this, and they presented there. It's very messy. What we did was to choose our constants such that the large K-squared dependence, I mean, K mu nu is a function of the K mu's, and delta mu nu's times a function pi of K-squared. So you look at this function pi of k-squared, it's really k-squared over the electron mass, okay? You look at it for large k-squared over electron mass squared, and what you find is that there's a coefficient times a logarithm, it's a logarithm of k-squared over m-squared, the fourth order. And we could adjust our constant in this calculation to match that constant, and everything is fine. We get the correct k4 for large k-squared over m-squared. For small k-squared over m-squared, the whole thing vanishes. But we wanted to check how ours vanished compared to the only other thing we could find in the literature where people have actually stated what their horrible-looking results, which are all over the page, combined to for small k-squared, and our result is too small by a small factor. So we're not agreeing at that point. And this is just because, I'm sure this is just because we chose, we have one constant. If we had one constant to choose and we had the correct formulation going between K2 and K4, that is, make it an appropriate change of those things, which I think we know how to do now, we should have gotten out completely the correct K4.
one last word, and then I absolutely shut up to QCD. If you try to do this to QCD, for QCD, you have difficulty in two regions. One of them is that there are ordered exponentials. You have Gell-Mann matrices all over the place, and you have ordered exponentials popping up everywhere. You have to have a way of handling those things. Secondly, your F squared in gauge theory involves 4 powers of A, not just 2. And so you have to be able to reduce 4 powers in the original Lagrangian, the original action, however you want to phrase this, you have to be able to reduce a functional integral with an exponential of 4 powers of A down to a functional integral with 2 powers of A. Now that can be done, but it requires another Gaussian weighted functional integral. So there's another, at the very end, if you could take care of the ordered exponential difficulties, which I believe we can, at the very end, you'd have to do another Gaussian, I hate to use the word instanton, but you have to do another Gaussian functional integral and approximate. And this is very much akin to old instanton approximations that people have used. The ordered exponential difficulties can be done in a very special way, which is an approximation, but just by demanding that every time you have an interaction, when two particles are going to exchange gluons and color can change, or one particle emits and absorbs, the color changes happen only at the, if you have two particles scattering, they happen at the point of closest approach. That is physically, there's not enough time for lots of color changes. These things happen so quickly, in proper time language, that only they happen at the smallest value, when the proper time takes on the smallest value. Smallest, largest, an appropriate value of proper time, relevant to the computation you're looking at. If you do that, then you can replace what Gambolini and I some years ago called the non-abelian physics by quasi-abelian physics. It's different from abelian physics. We did it, for example, for quark scattering in SU2, and we come out very nicely in SU2 with different differential cross sections for triplet and for singlet scattering. This is just the kind of thing that you want to generalize for quark in QCD. Not that we're interested in quark scattering, but this was the idea to see what you could do. There is an approximation called the quasi-abelian approximation, which you take care of. I am now done. Thank you for your patience. Sorry, I took so long.